record this, just for the record on the recording. This is the fourth session of Sociology 621. The topic for today is transformation. But we will begin with any other questions. Juhi, you had a question from...
About the last class, in the section about the exploitation, and you explained that capitalists want to maintain wage low, but they also maintain unemployment rate high to make workers vulnerable. I agree, but in economics or neoclassical economics, they will argue that the high unemployment rate will be a result of the high wage, like a minimum wage policy, like in the supply and demand curve. So, I mean, I don't agree with that, but how do you explain about the two arguments?
Okay, so economists argue that high minimum wages contribute to unemployment. Now, a couple of just little comments. First of all, virtually no economist says that the high minimum wages is the principal cause of unemployment. Mostly economists believe that unemployment, high rates of unemployment, reflect a lack of demand for the products of a particular economy, so that employers lack an incentive to expand and hire more workers. So at most, the argument is that on the margin, there's some part of unemployment which would be less if wages were lower. The empirical research on that for the United States shows that there's virtually no effect of the unemployment rate, on the unemployment rate of our minimum wage laws, because our minimum wage laws are so low. But also, there are countries that have very high minimum wages. Denmark, for example, has very high minimum wages and very low unemployment. Even under the current conditions, it has relatively low unemployment. And that's because they have all sorts of mechanisms in place to deal with unemployment, whereas we don't. We leave unemployment to the market largely, whereas in Denmark they have all sorts of retraining and labor market enhancement processes in order to increase the employment and reduce unemployment. But also, the argument, this is an argument we'll explore a bit more later, but the argument that capitalists have an interest in keeping wages as low as possible and having unemployment does not mean that capitalists want as much unemployment as possible, and or that they want wages to be absolutely as low as possible. It's just a statement about a general tendency within capitalism. They want to pay workers less rather than more, and they want unemployment rates to be high enough to make workers feel vulnerable. The key issue is they want workers to feel vulnerable. They want it to matter that you fire them. You know, if there's no costs to being fired, because it's very easy for a fired worker to get another job of comparable value to that worker, then the ability of employers to discipline their workers goes down. Now, when we discuss the concept of exploitation, I think this is a session that had to get, there's a wonderful session that had to get cut, which is about what's called the costs of job loss and the problem of consent, people consenting to their own exploitation, how to think about that. This was a topic in the section on ideology, not exploitation. It was bringing these two topics together. But the basic, I can give you the 30-second version. The basic idea is that employers actually want to pay, in general, pay workers more than the least possible wages they could pay them in order to make it more painful to be fired. That is, employers want to increase the costs of job loss. And one way you increase the cost of job loss is to pay workers a bit more than what's called the market clearing wage. That is the absolute bare wage you could pay them to get them to work. And the one way of thinking about this is the following. Suppose that you had a business with 100 employees, and you doing routine clerical work, and you offered them $70,000 a year, but said, once a year, somebody is going to randomly come around and see if you're working hard. And if you're not working up to our diligent standard, you will be fired on the spot. But you get $70,000 a year if you work hard. Now, that's a very cheap surveillance system, right? The employer doesn't have to spend much money on supervising the workers. And the chance, even if it's only one out of 300 or 250 or however many days of work a year, the chance that you'll be caught shirking when you're going to lose a really good paying job for that kind of routine clerical work is such that you could be pretty sure that everybody would work really hard. Now suppose that you pay them the absolute minimum you could get somebody to do that job, let's say $22,000 a year for that particular job. And you say, once a year, somebody's going to come by and check to see if you're working hard. Well, of course, you'd expect quite a lot of shirking because the chances of getting caught aren't that great and the job's pretty crappy anyway. And you could probably get another job that's paying as badly as this one. Okay, so that what that shows is that there's a trade-off for the employer about how much resource they're going to devote directly to extracting effort through supervision and monitoring versus how much resource they will devote to extracting effort by creating loyalty to the firm and a sense of cost of job loss. And that is an important trade-off. It's a trade-off affected by technology. Some jobs are really hard to supervise, so the only way you can get people to work hard in them is for them to feel a commitment to the job. That's not really a skill issue. Sometimes it's often bound up with skill, but it's a question of monitorability of the job. Some jobs which aren't all that skilled are still hard to monitor. It's hard to observe how well the person is doing the job. Well, that's all bound up with this issue of exploitation and bound up with why employers care about the unemployment rate. If the unemployment rate gets too low, then it gets harder to supervise people. Other follow-ups from the previous class. All right, now we're going to jump headlong into a dense thicket of ideas and issues. The problem of a theory of transformation. Oh, yes, there should be some. I have three left here. There should be more. Is there another? I made more than enough. Is this going to? Were there only three people missing them? One, two. Yes, good. Everybody's got an outline. No, you don't have an outline?
No, I have.
You have one? Okay.
Down here.
Okay. Problem of transformation.
That's a good question.
Yeah.
Before we start.
Yeah.
This week, in the coming two sessions, there are several suggested readings. I was wondering if sometimes the library doesn't have these books, and I was wondering if it's possible if we wanted them, if we could stop by your office and copy them or something.
Sure.
Absolutely.
I'm more than happy. I tried to put on the electronic reserve at least some of the more important of the supplementary and suggested readings. So you should check to see if they're on the electronic reserve. But any book that I have that isn't, of course I'd be happy to. The books that I've recommended to buy, I've done so because I do think they're worth having in libraries, in permanent libraries. There's a couple of them that a couple of Cambridge University Press books that have become, for really not obvious reasons, incredibly expensive, way more expensive than they were when they were initially issued. And given modern printing technologies, it just doesn't, I don't understand quite why they're being priced the way they are. Some of those I checked online, and there are used versions available. The Jan Elster Making Sense of Marx is an example. But I certainly don't expect people to pay $75 for that paperback, which is, I think, what they're asking for now. I have put the chapters, so for any books that I recommended that you buy, but which have become super expensive, those chapters are available on electronic reserve.
You combine the next two into one.
Yeah.
Is there a reading that we should focus on for next time?
I think you just plow through those readings.
Okay.
What I would recommend, the Cohen book, I think I've commented a little bit about it. I think it's an extraordinary piece of work. These are matters of taste as much as anything else. I really like the extreme care with which he deals with every single concept. So some people find that excruciating, whereas I find it really engrossing to see the care with which a concept is worked with. The way I would recommend you read that book, again, this depends upon your background and how comfortable you are with that level of analytical precision. I would encourage you to do a very quick reading of all the assigned stuff. You know, in the sense of kind of checking the first paragraph of each section and getting the lay of the land of this book. And then read it in a kind of relaxed way. You know, don't be too impatient with yourself. If you hit some very dense bits, just go on and then come back to them. You know, rather than feel real anxious about this. I think that although it's a very logically constructed work where pieces do fit together, he's so careful about explaining each section of what he's arguing that you can move on even if you haven't fully come to terms with what he's written before. I think his interpretation of Marx on the questions he addresses, that is, how should we think about this broad problem of the theory of history, I think his interpretation is correct. That is, I think it's faithful to Marx. It's not just internally coherent, but it's also a valid reading of Marx. But it's also the case that Marx himself, as a writer over the course of his life, wrote vast amounts of things that bear on the question of a theory of history, and they're not consistent one to the other. He argues different things at different times because of the historical and rhetorical context of what he's writing. And therefore, you can construct an alternative theory of history from the one that Cohen does. My view is that these alternative theories of history actually cease to be a theory of history. That what Cohen has done is reconstructed Marx in the following sense. He said, what aspects of Marx's work, if brought together and cleaned up, would constitute a full-bore theory of history? As we'll see when we discuss that, that implies that the expression, a theory of history, has a particular meaning. I think Cohen's correct on this, that other things which go under that name aren't properly theories of history. They're concepts of history, or they're historical theories. But they aren't treating history as such as an objective theory that can be theorized in a scientific way. And Cohen's reconstruction is a valiant effort at showing what such a theory would be like, drawing on the threads of such, or the elements of such a theory within the Marxist tradition. That's what we'll do on Wednesday. The point of that will, and why we would want such a theory, is part of what today's lecture will help set up. All right, a theory of transformation. Why do we need such a theory? Now, in the syllabus, I cite Marx's famous 11th thesis on Feuerbach. This is one of the iconic sentences from Marx's work. Philosophers have only interpreted the world in various ways. The point is to change it. Right, so that's a kind of classic statement. That's the quote from the early Marx that's often given to emphasize the unity of theory and practice, that the point of theory is to inform practice, and the point of practice is to transform the world, not just to interpret it. I think there's a number of important implications of that famous slogan, and implications which inform then the way we go about producing a theory which is relevant to the problem of transforming the world. First of all, the sentence only makes sense if it is seen to imply that human agency matters. The sentence doesn't make any sense. I mean, it would be kind of a pointless thing to say if you believe that history unfolds entirely behind the backs of actors, in which conscious, deliberate, intentional action by people is irrelevant. If you think the transformation of the world is something for which deliberate strategy and ideas play no role or no important role, then philosophers have only interpreted the world in various ways. The point is to change it. It would be a kind of pointless thing to point out, as it were. So there has to be some role for agency and conscious strategic action in your theory of the world itself in order for this to be a good slogan to help guide our actions and our theoretical work. There's another theorist less well known, certainly among sociologists, than Marx, of course. Almost nobody is as well known as Marx. Kurt Lewin, Kurt Levine is the way he pronounced his own name. He was German, but Americans call him Kurt Lewin, a social psychologist, German refugee in the 30s and 40s, one of the founders of social psychology. He had this very nice phrase, "There's nothing so practical as a good theory." That's a very Marxian thing to say. I mean, I don't think he was saying it in that spirit. But that basically, what good theories do is help you engage the world in better ways. Because what good theories do is help you understand the consequences of different alternatives. And that's what practice is all about, figuring out the consequences of what you're doing. That's the first point, that agency has to play a role. So whatever we want, however we deploy and develop our theory of history, our theory of society, our theory of change, we have to figure out how to locate human agency within that process. A purely structural account might be a perfectly good account, but it's certainly not one that's encouraged by the 11th thesis on Feuerbach. A second theme, and this I think is not quite as simple an implication of the statement, but I nevertheless think we can embrace it as an implication, is the statement is not just a thesis about the role of agency, it's about the role of philosophers, so to speak, of intellectuals. So it's a claim not merely that people's agency and deliberate purposes matter for understanding history, but that the ideas produced by intellectuals who think and worry about these matters also matter. It's almost a reflexive statement. Marx, writing the 11th thesis of Feuerbach, is saying the 11th thesis of Feuerbach matters. People should take it seriously. Well, the 11th thesis of Feuerbach is written in an academic type of essay, engaging a particular philosophical tradition of the time, a particular form of materialism. And Marx is, in effect, saying it matters whether you understand this in one way or another. And it matters not just because of the way it might affect your interpretation of the world. It matters because it might help inform the way you want to transform the world. So not just agency matters, but intellectuals matter. What's completely ambiguous, which this sentence has nothing to say about, and which I think remains ambiguous, as to whether the implication of that is that intellectuals matter because they should be on the barricades with everybody else, or intellectuals matter because the ideas they produce will affect the way people behave on the barricades, so to speak. I think the claim is the latter. I think it's agnostic on the question of how intellectuals as such, what their personal role as persons should be within the organizations of struggle. That's a separate matter. That'll be hugely variable historically, depending upon the kinds of conflicts, the way struggles are organized, the relationship between the masses of people and specialized intellectuals. All sorts of things will affect the question, should intellectuals play leadership roles? Should they be writing pamphlets? Should they be teaching in universities? What's the most effective way by which they can develop ideas and get them in the world in ways that matter? I don't think there's any abstract formula about that question. All that's being claimed is that the ideas matter The ideas, and I would add, the ideas are difficult, and they need to be produced by people who spend the amount of time and effort and seriousness to produce them and change them. And this, of course, raises a whole range of problems, which we will be returning to in many different contexts in the course. And that's the problem of exactly how do ideas matter in the world if you're trying to transform it. What really is the role of new ideas, of critiques of old ideas? How should we think about this question? What do ideas do in the world? Our section of the course in the last 3 or 4 weeks on ideology is centrally about that. I mean, that's what the theory of ideology is all about, is about how particular structures of ideas and their transformation matter for the kinds of themes that we'll be discussing throughout this semester. What I would say, just to give you a kind of synoptic view of account of my view about why how ideas matter, I would say make the following two main points, with then a kind of third point, which is a sort of implication of the first two. The first is ideas matter because strategy matters. That is, transforming the world requires strategy, which means having knowledge about the consequences of different courses of action for the kinds of transformations we want, and having such a theory requires theory. I mean, it requires serious understanding of how the world works in order to know what kinds of struggles, what kinds of interventions are likely to have what kinds of effects. In order to formulate an account of strategy, you need to know the nature of the obstacles you face. That requires a theory of how the system works. In order to have a theory of strategy, you have to understand the contradictions in any strategic choice. That requires a theory of how the world works. So, first point is, ideas matter because strategy matters. That would be the kind of simple form. And the second point is, ideas matter, theories matter, because it's crucial to learn the correct lessons from one's failures. Ultimately, transforming the world is a problem of experimentation, trial and error. You know, it's just simply too complicated, I think, to in fact have a comprehensive formulaic theory of what to do, in which you are simply applying, you know, social struggle is a simply applied theory. It's not like that. It's not like engineering, where you develop your science and you do your test models, and then when you're building your 10th building, you're really just applying the same rules with the same expectations of consequences of one kind of girder versus another, based on the body of knowledge which has been shown to robustly predict whether the building is going to fall over. Right? That's how engineering knowledge affects building. It enables you to know which strategies of building it will lead to the building falling over or not, so to speak. Well, social contexts are way too complicated and uncertain to have that character, but there is this crucial problem of how do you learn from all the trial and error and experiments? And the problem of learning the wrong lessons from failure is a huge problem. And the problem of knowing how to learn on the fly in the middle of complex conditions is also a huge problem. Let me tell you a vignette that came from this class in the mid-1980s, which, this class, as I said at the beginning, is the class that I identify with most. It's the class through which my own ideas have developed in the most dynamic way over the last 35 years that I've been a professor. Well, in the mid-80s, we had the following, for me, quite extraordinary event in the class. It turned out that the assistant minister of education from Grenada, this was after the American invasion of Grenada and the displacement of the socialist government of that country. This is 2 years later, that he was a grad student in the education school here. He's a young guy, you know, he's in his, probably at that point in his early 30s. And he had been The Assistant Secretary of, or whatever was the title of education in the country at the time of the American overthrow, invasion and overthrow of the Grenadian government. So in this class, we were chugging along. It was filled with lots of very feisty activist grad students, very politically active, and there was increasing impatience in the course of the class with the level of abstraction of a lot of the discussions. You know, they wanted more concrete, on-the-ground, historical and empirical discussions of practical situations. And I was continuing to elaborate concepts, clarifying distinctions, going into elaborate discussions of particular aspects of the conceptual frameworks that we were discussing. And at one point, there was a group of students who basically got sufficiently irritated that they asked if we could cancel a class and kind of have a criticism, self-criticism, collective discussion on the direction the class was going. You know, was this the right way to do it? Now, on the one hand, I am very sympathetic and appreciative of that level of seriousness of people, that they had a way that they thought it should be done, even if it wasn't congruent with my own preferences on this. So I, with a little bit of anxiety, welcomed this break in the action. So we had this discussion going. And then this guy stands up, gets the floor. And I thought, oh God, I'm going to really get skewered now. I didn't know him very well at that point. Because I figured, I mean, if there's anybody who had street creds in the class, it was this guy. He had thrown his lot in with the socialist, quasi-revolutionary government of Grenada, had been overthrown by the American Marines. He was not politically high up in the party of the organization, so that he still managed to go to graduate school under Michael Apple's tutelage at Wisconsin. So he said that he really wanted to say something. And I was, of course, welcomed it, but I, in my heart of hearts, I was feeling some trepidation. But then what he said was this. He said, if the leadership of the Grenadian Socialist Party had taken this course, we would have been in a much better position to cope with the contradictions of our situation and to figure out how, in the moments of uncertainty, not to apply formulas, not to just then immediately go to the set point of the most extreme position because it was the most comfortable, but to grapple with the complexities of the time. You know, he gave a kind of full-blown affirmation of the... and basically the importance of clear-headed analytical thinking, and you only develop that by grappling with ideas. So this is a different kind of point about how ideas matter. It's not so much actually always that the content of the particular ideas matter, but taking them seriously and thinking and worrying about them and learning how to really parse and put things together and to know when you don't know what you're doing. You know, to really have a full recognition of where the gaps are. And that only comes from working with ideas in this kind of serious way. It's the practice of theory, if you will, to do it this way. And that's what he felt mattered. Well, that had a big impact, I think, on everybody in the class. I did try my best in the aftermath of our little teach-in about theory and practice to bring in more examples, and I think I do that more now than I did in those earlier years anyway. So that's the that's part of this reason why ideas matter. Ideas matter, and being good at thinking about ideas matter. So it's not just being taught. That's why, and I think that's really the difference between the practice in a class like this, in which the practice is primarily ideological, my trying to inculcate some ideas into your heads, and our practice is scientific, my trying to help us collectively learn how to think and worry about ideas, in which, of course, there still has to be content. You can't do that abstracted from content. We are discussing exploitation, oppression, history, class, state, you know, rich, interesting ideas. But we're working on them, and that's really where the action is. All of this plays a particularly complex role within the Marxist tradition because of this body of ideas having this dual reality, which I mentioned in an earlier class. Marxism as a ideology of mobilization and inspiration, and Marxism as a framework of scientific analysis of societies, its contradictions and possibilities. There is a tension between these. The danger is always what I like to call charismatic wishful thinking. You know, we want the most visionary and optimistic faces of these ideas to solve our problems and to make our life easy when we're dealing with particular contexts. Whereas the scientific impulse is to always make our life difficult, that is to cultivate critical skepticism. And the task I think we have is to cultivate critical skepticism without sliding into cynicism, to kind of maintain the enthusiasm of the charismatic wishful thinking of Marxism as an ideology with the critical skepticism of Marxism as a social science. It's in some ways an impossible duality, but it's an impossibility that we have to cope with. Well, that's why we need a theory of transformation if we want to transform the world. Why we shouldn't just do it by bootstrapping and intuition. What kind of theory do we want, though? There's many different types of theories. There's a lot of words that get used to describe theories. Some imply a super ambitious, comprehensive theory. Terms that get used are paradigms, grand theories, grand narratives, general theory. Those are words that are used to capture the really most ambitious kinds of theory. There was a time in my own work in which I framed the goals of Marxism this way, that is, I situated my work as an effort to reconstruct Marxism as a comprehensive social scientific paradigm. Paradigm meaning a closed system in which all the elements are in place to provide a framework for addressing any question you might have. Kind of comprehensive closed system. In the way that, you know, arguably biology and physics are paradigmatic. It's not that they've answered every question, but they have all the elements and theoretical connections necessary to approach any existing puzzle. And then, of course, there are accumulations of puzzles that remain puzzling, that they haven't solved. And it remains an open question whether that's because there's a flaw in the overall comprehensive design of the paradigm, or there just haven't been the right discoveries yet to figure out the puzzles. What are called anomalies may or may not be threats to paradigms. They can simply be the unresolved problems that remain puzzling. Well, physics, chemistry, biology, they all have these kinds of comprehensive paradigms. When I originally embarked on my Marxian sociology career, I sort of framed things as Marxism versus sociology. Sometimes it was Marxism versus bourgeois social science. And I saw the effort as really trying to reconstruct Marxism in a way that it would be a successful paradigmatic social science. I have really pulled back from that as a way of thinking about it. Now, it's not because I believe that there's some principle which would say that's an impossible endeavor. I'm agnostic on that. I'm not anti-paradigmatic, as it were. But I don't believe it's the most productive way of thinking about what a Marxist enterprise is within the broad problem of an emancipatory social theory. I now think that it's better to think of what we're doing as thinking through the components of a theoretical framework that establishes a comprehensive set of concepts and logically connected agendas to solve certain particular kinds of problems. I have a more pragmatist view, in a way, of what the theoretical problem is here. It's to build frameworks that help us solve particular kinds of problems. And the frameworks consist of menus of concepts and their interconnections and agendas. You know, they put some order into all the things we might be interested in and show us how they fit together, but without knitting it all together in some comprehensive package where everything is assumed to fit together well and to provide a sufficient grounds for all of the things we might want to study. This kind of theory is a sort of pragmatist compromise between the ambitions of a paradigm and the chaotic fragmentation of purely empiricist social science. So it's not that I've abandoned completely the spirit of the paradigmatic way of thinking about theory, but I've kind of tempered it by wanting it to be more deeply engaged with the pragmatic problems of solving certain specific problems. And building agendas and frameworks, I think, is the better way of posing that rather than building paradigms. And that's essentially what the chapter on elements of a theory of transformation does. It tries to define what is the full agenda of problems we have to solve if we want to develop a really compelling theory of transformation. So it's a kind of research program of tasks that need to be done. And then within each of those tasks, I lay out in quite general terms where I think the state of knowledge is. What are the mechanisms, the kinds of specific concepts we need to deal with each of these big agenda items? This is not the way that theoretical frameworks are usually produced. Certainly, if you were to read Marx's work from beginning to end, I don't think there is any text that Marx wrote that has the character of agenda setting and building piece step by step in a logical manner the full framework of some kind of analysis. Each of his texts develops in particular historical contexts to engage particular empirical and theoretical problems without him stepping back from that and then reconstructing it all into an ordered framework. So a lot of Marxist work since then has tried to do that in various ways. Marx has these few precious, usually very short pieces where some of that happens. The Cohen book is largely built around a 4 or 5 page essay that Marx wrote as the preface to a contribution to a critique of political economy. That's where he lays out in the schematic form. It's the only place that he really kind of lays out all the elements of what a theory of history would be, but without any explication and virtually no justification for any of the components of it. It's a fantastic 5 pages, but you know, 5 pages won't cut it for a persuasive theory of history. So this is a much more schematic kind of practice of theory building than one finds in most of the Marxist tradition. The schematism of the schematic character of it, you know, by schematic I mean I say, look, there are 4 points, they fit together in this way, then we have 2 agenda items. You know, if you've read the chapter, you get that. Some people hate this. Most quoted review of Envisioning Real Utopias, it's by a historian at UCLA named Russell Jacoby. If you want to read, I guess some of you are nodding your head, so some of you have seen this review.
It's linked on the Wikipedia file. So
what?
Conveniently. I said it's linked in the Wikipedia file on you, so people probably find it through that.
Right. So Russell Jacoby trashed the book in the most venomous, I mean, it is by far the most venomous review I've ever read, I think, of any academic book, not just mine. he just relentlessly ridicules the book from beginning to end as being, and it's largely because I think of this character, of this aspect of the work, that is, that I attempt to systematically create a framework with logically connected elements, with clear distinctions. And he just finds that stultifying and opaque. I mean, the part of the criticism, I understand where he's coming from, the part of the criticism that I just don't see how he can be quite honest in this saying is that to say that the book is unclear, you know, I mean, I think mostly people who have read it feel that they understand my points and they understand why I make them, even if they disagree with them. And he thinks it's all totally obscure. Any rate, this is only one way of doing theory, and some people, as we have empirical demonstration, hate it. I think it's a valuable way of doing theoretical work at a certain stage in the development of ideas. Now, this would have been completely both inappropriate and probably impossible for somebody in 1850, you know, in the thick of the development of the Marxian corpus of ideas, to sit down and say, okay, how do all these pieces fit together? What's the starting? You know, that's not how it works. This is a work of consolidation and reflection and systemization that comes late in the process of developing theoretical frameworks. All right, that's all introduction. Now we get to the elements of the theory. Now, my ideas on these matters have not progressed dramatically since I wrote the book. You know, this is still the way. Some things we'll be discussing, I have new ideas even beyond this. But this broad framework, I think, is still the way I would go about it. And I'm sure, at least those of you who have had a chance to read it with some care, I'm sure you have lots of questions and issues you'd like to raise about it. So here's how I think we should proceed. There are four themes in this. There are four big parts to the theory of transformation: a theory of social reproduction, a theory of the gaps and contradictions in reproduction, a theory of the underlying dynamics and trajectory of unintended social change, and a theory of transformative strategies. And so those are the four big items of agenda. And for each of them, especially for the first, I have an elaborate set of specific elements and concepts that go to building the theories we need within that. So what I thought I would do is go through these one at a time to very quickly just rehearse the central ideas within each, and then for us to have a discussion about that component and then move on to the next. Okay? So first, social reproduction. Social reproduction, the term social reproduction, does not have a stable meaning in social theory. It's used in all sorts of ways. So for example, Pierre Bourdieu uses the term social reproduction primarily to refer to the intergenerational reproduction of status. So it's how rich people reproduce their social position through their children intergenerationally. Indeed, that's an aspect of social reproduction, but I'm using it in this much broader sense of reproducing a structure of social relations. This element, I think, is the centerpiece of most critical theories of society. The most elaborated aspects of critical theory center around, on the one hand, a diagnosis of the harms created by existing structures, and on the other, an analysis of this institutional processes that maintain those harms over time. Right, so you've got nastiness and then the reproduction of nastiness. That's the centerpiece, I think, of most critical theory. You might, sometimes when I presented this stuff, people have thought it a little odd that the starting point for a theory of transformation is a theory of reproduction. But I think if you think about it, just in a kind of logical way, how you want to really deepen your understanding of the tasks you face in transforming the world, it is a good logical starting point. It's basically saying the first thing you have to figure out are the barriers to change. And that's what a theory of social reproduction is. It's basically a theory of the obstacles to social transformation. I elaborate this in terms of a series of contrasts and kind of subcategories. So, for example, I draw a contrast between passive and active reproduction. Passive reproduction are all the ways in which social relationships are reproduced simply by the mundane activities of people who live within those relations. This is very close to Bourdieu's notion of habitus. It's very much the same idea. Bourdieu's notion of habitus has this character of the way in which people are formed with particular dispositions to act in the roles they occupy in such a way as to reproduce the distinctions and relations among those roles. So habitus in Bourdieu is not merely a description of individuals and how they behave and why they behave the way they do, but how it fits together with the way other people are located in a manner that reproduces those relations. When you're all students, you go to classes, you've all been extremely well socialized as to what you do in a class, what the appropriate response when a professor is talking. You're all, you know, your eyes are directed this way, you're taking notes, you're doing all the things that are reproducing a particular kind of social relation between professors and students that's imbued with a certain authority structure, a status structure, at its best, a mentoring relation, which is much less inegalitarian, much more, has much more reciprocities to it. So all these relations we're all familiar with, and our practices in a mundane, unreflected way, just that's how you do it, reaffirm these kinds of relations. They don't disrupt them. And thus these relations get reproduced. I'm not disrupted so that I feel comfortable the next time I teach a class doing it sort of the same way I've done it in the past. You're not disrupted, you feel comfortable doing it, doing your student-y thing in this class, and you'll reproduce it in the next class too. So this is mundane passive reproduction. But then there's also active reproduction. Active reproduction refers to all the different ways in which there are specific devices in place to ensure that the relations get reproduced. And one way of thinking about it is that active reproduction is all about the mechanisms needed to maintain harmonious passive reproduction. Right? So passive reproduction doesn't go on just by sheer inertia. There are things which nudge it back into place. Now, sometimes that doesn't take much work. Other times it takes huge work. Under certain kinds of social relations, in the absence of active reproduction, the passive reproduction would deteriorate pretty quickly. Now, that's the kind of central argument. I'm skipping to point three in the under A. This is what I consider the sort of foundational argument about a theory of social reproduction among critical theorists, which says that social structures and institutions that systematically impose harms on people require vigorous mechanisms of active social reproduction in order to be sustained. This is really an important idea. And it's not a trivial one. In fact, when I've said this at various times in different parts of the world, some people really challenge it. They believe that harms and oppressive impressions can exist and become so internalized in people that they require no special vigorous efforts to maintain it. And I think that's an illusion. I'd like to see the society where it is the case that severe harms and oppressions exist by the kind of ordinary diagnosis that a critical theorist would have, in which there aren't very vigorous institutional mechanisms in place to reproduce those harms. So the argument is that harms and oppressions would generate strong active resistance unless some counter mechanisms exist. The idea here is then that the apparent acceptance of people, the apparent acceptance of people of those harms comes from their feeling that nothing can be done. It's resignation and demoralization that then masks itself as acceptance. And that if there wasn't this active, coercive enforcement of the parameters of those relations, people would discover that they could resist and act actively to transform things. This implies some pretty strong claims about the human condition and human nature. And indeed, it implies some transhistorical, transcontextual views about human nature. that's not very fashionable these days, right? You know, in social theory, the fashionable thing is to not make strong claims about human essence. That's called essentialism, right? One of the big sins of contemporary theory. I do embrace the notion that there are some essential features about human nature that we can, however imperfectly, identify. I'm not saying that we can have absolutely clear knowledge about this. So you see, the problem is to make a claim about human nature that's transcontextual and universal is difficult because we're all formed in contexts. Our preferences, motivations, capacities, they're all shaped by the institutions in which we live. We don't observe the kind of universal. And therefore, it's not a trivial matter to make such claims. Nevertheless, I think we can make some claims. And they underwrite this fundamental theorem of social reproduction. That is, when conditions are oppressive, active social reproduction is vigorously needed in order to maintain the relations. Yeah.
Yeah, I've got a question going back to your point three. You write here that it requires vigorous mechanisms with active social reproduction. I was just thinking, if you had like a system, like an institution set up deliberately, you know, to, I guess that somehow like perpetuated like human suffering, like some kind of institutional force or government institution. But you had people go to their jobs in those institutions and just went about their daily activities within those institutions. Wouldn't that be more of like passive inside of active?
Sure, sure. So in American slavery, there were slave foremen. They were the people who were responsible for seeing that slaves didn't run away. Right? Now, my fundamental thesis says that if they all disappeared, slaves would run away. That is, that slaves had not internalized their inferiority and their subordination to such an extent that in the absence of the slave driver and the institutions of the posses that would chase after them, they would have run away. Not on the first day, and not all of them, but that the institution could not have been reproduced without that active social reproduction. Now, the people who do the active social reproduction could have internalized their roles as just the mundane thing. This is just their job. Their job was to watch, just like a prison guard's job. And they might not have experienced their own jobs as active reproduction. They are hired for that role. They get paid well enough. And they do their job under the threat of being fired by the slave owner. So there's a coercive element in their job that is the threat of being fired. That's an active thing. The slave owner is keeping an eye on the slave guards, you know, the foreman, to see that they're doing their job right. That's not passive. That's very conscious. The slave driver says, I need to hire 3 more guards because the slaves are getting restless. There's been escapes in the neighborhood. There's Matt Turner's rebellion or whatever. So there's a conscious act of reproduction that includes the decision of how much surveillance to hire and to employ. But within those relations, it gets normalized, it gets routinized. The slave foremen are just doing their job. They're not inherently brutal people. You know, it may be that there's some self-selection into those roles so that you need people who are particularly uncompassionate to do them, but not necessarily. I don't think in American prisons, which have terrible conditions in many of them, I don't think it's the case that most prison guards are probably heavily selected on dimensions of callousness. To the extent that they become callous, it's because of psychological reactions to the conditions under which they do their job. So these are strong claims. You know, I believe that we can identify harms and oppressions in societies where the actors, if you ask them, are you oppressed, would say no. And that my hypothesis would be, I'm right, you're wrong, you don't understand your own conditions, and the empirical demonstration of this would be, let us remove the sanctions and coercions and see how long this oppression continues. in Saudi Arabia if suddenly all the rules that govern the behavior of women, that they have to be in the presence of a man, they have to cover their faces in public, they can't drive, if all those rules were simply no longer enforced, there'd be a very rapid deterioration of the degree of gender subordination. It could not remain intact, my argument would be, on the basis of cultural norms alone. It has to be enforced. Yeah?
So do you think the mechanisms that keep, you know, the passive reproduction keep going, do you think that owes itself anything to the division of labor in modern society? I mean, I know the works of Zimbardo and Milgram, a social psychologist studying evil, how people will go along with orders in order, you know, the studies, the prison experiment,
right.
And they found that when tasks are divided and people only owe to one point, like there's pressing a button and it shocks someone in the other room, it allows them to just more tacitly go along with the demand, and that altogether it makes them far more passive and they don't own up to it.
I mean, that, I don't know if I would, how much weight I would give to that mechanism as opposed to others in explaining the extent to which people routinize the performance of particular kinds of tasks in an existing structure and go along passively. That's passive in a slightly different sense than what I'm referring to as passive reproduction. What I'm referring to passive reproduction is how just doing our ordinary mundane life reproduces the relations themselves. So going into a store and buying and selecting among the 300 boxes of cereal and paying for it when you leave contributes to reproducing a set of commercial relations in which 300 boxes of cereal are provided and access to them is through the exchange of money. And that's the structure of relations that defines this as a capitalist market for boxes of cereal. And in our mundane activity, unthinkingly, we reproduce that just by the ordinary way that we engage in that practice. That's passive reproduction. The laws of theft and shoplifting, which involve putting CCT cameras in place, it's active reproduction. The active reproduction contributes to the passive reproduction in the sense that it helps to routinize and normalize these everyday activities. So that, I mean, that's the kind of argument that's being made here. Let me get through the social reproduction and then we'll take our short break, okay? I'm not going to go through all of these in any detail. I want to, item two, which we just skipped over, we're going to have an intense discussion of the problem of functionalism next week. This is a key problem in social theory, so those of you who are sociologists and are interested in social theory, this has way broader relevance than just the Marxian stuff we're talking about here. What it means to have a functional explanation. I just want to make one point here about the active and passive reproduction as it's connected to this fundamental theorem of social reproduction. The fundamental theorem is you got to have active reproduction when you have a relation that's oppressive. Otherwise, the relation will trigger resistance and transformation. So you need active reproduction. That comes close to a functionalist explanation. That is, it's saying that the function of those active mechanisms of active reproduction, its function is to reproduce the passive reproduction. And when you observe a form of active reproduction, then you're tempted to explain it functionally. That is, why do we have property rights laws? Why do we have police? Aha, they serve the function of reproducing capitalism. So that's what's called a functional explanation. We're going to engage and take apart that kind of explanation in some detail next week. I'm just alerting you to the first appearance of functional type explanations here. Sundar, did...
We can talk about it.
Yeah, I think it's a super interesting problem. as at a purely intellectual level. So, you know, if you like philosophy of science and the problems of explanation and how to think meta-theoretically about them, functional explanation is a terrific topic. But we'll engage it probably more painfully than everybody will want next week. Okay, the fourth point on the thing. This is also invoking some big social theory issues. There's a standard idea in contemporary sociology. Its roots go back to Hobbes, which is called the problem of order, of social order, in which the central reason why we need all sorts of institutions in society, central explanation, is that they are a solution to a problem of order. In the Hobbesian version, in the absence of a state, it's the war of all against all. The war of all against all makes life brutish and short, nasty, brutish and short. There's four, I forget. All Hobbes, the war of all against all in the state of nature, life is nasty, brutish, and short. But there's a fourth term in the litany of problems. It's basically chaos, disorder, mutual predation. And what our institutions do, both cultural institutions around norms, but also political institutions around the state, what all these institutions do is solve the problem of order and create social integration. So that's one way of thinking about these things. So that the problem of social reproduction is social order. I'm arguing for a different counterfactual. So the counterfactual to social reproduction in the Hobbesian view is chaos. The counterfactual to social reproduction in the Marxian view is revolution. Not chaos, but transformation. These are very different frameworks for understanding why we need a systematic structure of active reproduction. One is to solve a problem that we all face, that is, every human being has an interest in social order. The war of all against all is bad for everybody, versus, well, the reason why we have these active institutions of social reproduction is because it reproduces a structure of social relations in which some people benefit at the expense of others. That is, it blocks emancipatory transformation. These are two different coordinates for the problem of order and the problem of transformation. And they're embedded in very, obviously, different theoretical agendas altogether. That's a nice distinction, I think, to keep in mind when you take courses in sociological theory, because lurking in the background of a lot of theory is one or the other of these views. Sometimes it's not clear, and that's a nice thing to kind of think about. In Bourdieu, what's the counterfactual to the stable structures of habitus? Is it chaos or is it transformation? Bourdieu doesn't have an explicit theory of transformation, but what's the shadow behind his arguments? It's, I think, a useful way to approach any particular social theory. The chapter then elaborates these different mechanisms. I don't think I need to go through those. These are all meant to be an elaboration of specific mechanisms of active reproduction. So the fundamental thesis is you got to have active reproduction. Then the question is, what are the mechanisms that do it? And these are the way I've parsed the four primary types of mechanisms. Now, these are each placeholders for an elaborated specification. Coercion is pretty general. There's lots of forms of coercion that figure. It's the same for institutional rules, ideology, and interests. And then finally, I argue, and this is something that we will discuss especially when we get to the theory of the state, that these configurations of coercion, rules, ideology, and interests, they can get packaged in different ways. There's different ways of organizing the interconnections among these. And a useful contrast is between what could be called a despotic configuration of active reproduction and a hegemonic configuration of active reproduction. Both of these are ways of reproducing a structure of oppressive social relations. but they do so by configuring coercion, rules, ideology, and interests in different ways. And this simple binary contrast, of course, the world isn't binary, there's all sorts of gradations and mixed forms. A despotic configuration is one in which coercion and rules do the central work. They're the most active central components of reproducing social relations. And ideology and interests mainly serve to reinforce coercion and rules. Whereas in a hegemonic configuration, ideology and interests are the central ways in which social reproduction takes place. And coercion and rules primarily should be understood as supporting the effectiveness of ideology and interests. So it's simply the inversion of the priority of interconnection between these different mechanisms of social reproduction. The hegemonic system is typically described as one that's grounded in consent, that's the term that's used, consent that's protected by coercion. Consent basically means a combination of ideology and interests. That's what's being encapsulated by that formula. All right, that's the very rapid run through of the first of the four elements of transformation, social reproduction. I think we should take our 6-minute break, and then we'll begin with questions that you might have about the reproduction. The reason I'm spending most time on this, I think it is the hardest of the four elements. And so I wanted to cover that in more detail than we will have time for the others. Okay, so let's reconvene at 25 after. Quick break. Okay, so the floor is open for issues around this first cluster of problems in a theory of transformation, social reproduction. Nate and then Max.
So one question I have is how you think about our book. You talk mostly about active institutions of active reproduction reinforcing passive reproduction, but I've also heard and I understand Bourdieu and some other people to understand to be a flow the other way as well, that passive reproduction, having a particular habitus, tends to reshape institutions.
Right, so the way I describe that, I agree. That there's a interconnection both directions. That's also a hallmark of functionalist-type explanations, is that there's feedback processes along both. The question is, how do we elaborate those connections? So one way is the following. If you've got well-functioning processes of passive reproduction, it puts a much weaker burden on the mechanisms of active reproduction. The task of active reproduction is much simpler than when the passive reproduction is constantly disrupted, where there's lots of resistance being generated within the mundane activities of everyday life because, for various reasons, then you need stronger and more systematic forms of active reproduction. More social resources have to be devoted to them. To the extent, therefore, for example, that workers have internalized the Protestant work ethic and feel a moral obligation to put a hard day's work in, you'll need fewer foremen to supervise their work than you would if you have a bunch of first-generation workers displaced from a agricultural setting where they were self-governing and autonomous individuals, not subjected to the will of a boss, and didn't kind of value that subordinate obligation to put a hard day's work or something like that. So passive reproduction affects the nature of the institutions of active reproduction in the sense that sometimes active reproduction is called upon to do a lot of work. Other times, it could be pretty much in the shadows. That's partially what this despotic versus hegemonic form is all about. Max, you had.
Just about the fundamental proposition of social reproduction, does this imply then, what's the implication as to people consciously doing things that are against their best interest? Say, for instance, an air traffic control tower worker that blows your salary again, or something along those lines. Something that just, when you lay out everything, doesn't make sense for them to go along this path, but they do it anyways, which has been seen historically.
Sure, sure. Well, a lot of passive reproduction is precisely people acting in ways that are contrary to their interests. Mm-hmm. Now, whether exactly how you diagnose that, I think, has to be context specific. Workers going to work and dutifully working hard and not causing trouble, well, is that or is that not against their interests? Well, it's sort of in their interest to behave that way because it increases their job security. It means that they're less likely to be labeled a troublemaker by their boss. It makes them less vulnerable if conditions increase to make them vulnerable. So in some ways it's in their interests. And in other ways it's not, because it means that they reinforce their existing subordination in ways that makes it less likely over time that it would improve. So often at the level of individual motivation, it's pretty hard to know whether people are acting against their interests or in their interests. In the Ronald Reagan case, here in political competition, there is typically a very strong role for active reproduction. That is, there's a machinery of ideology production. Campaigns are conscious efforts to get people to do things. They're not just passive in the background. They're deliberately designed to do that. Sometimes they're deliberately designed to have people discount certain aspects of their interests and put weight on the other. Fear, for example, is a classic instrument of active reproduction. You have the potential of strong solidarity between black and white workers, which is a threat to the intensity of their subordination. Not necessarily a threat to the system, but a threat to the intensity of their subordination. You invoke racial fears as a way of dividing black and white workers, and therefore making the working class as a whole more easily controlled. Well, that's active reproduction. That's not passive reproduction. It's, say, active use of the instrumentalities of the state or of the media or whatever to reproduce the subordination of the class as a whole. So in the Reagan case, it was probably that air traffic controls were well-paid, privileged workers that were more concerned about tax rates and things like that than they were their vulnerability as employees, which they incorrectly viewed as secure. It was similar in the protests here last spring. The head of the state firefighters union publicly apologized for their union having supported Walker in the election. Well, it was very much the same thing. They knew that Walker was a conservative Republican, an anti-tax Republican. They did not think he was going to be a Tea Party extremist. That wasn't part of the campaign in the previous November. So they supported him for the usual kind of conservative privileged worker support for right-wing, for conservative politicians. And they felt they were duped. Wow. But that's, I think, those are all problems of active reproduction more than passive reproduction. There's another, yeah.
I'm just curious as to how active reproduction, these mechanisms, develop over time, you know, and change from one. I'm sure that has to be in view with how the state develops in particular ways and all those complexities, but do you think that that some of these, the large ones, you know, the police, for instance, are they the result of deliberative and conscious action on behalf of the oppressors? And, I mean, are there people that are,
So, what I think that the term active needs to be taken seriously. That is, they all involve in purposes. They're by their design. They're designed in this way to accomplish something. Right? So the police were initially introduced, there was a time before there was organized police. As urbanization increased in the course of capitalist development, I think Britain was the first country to have an ordinary municipally paid police force, as opposed to just private security guards, right? So lots of wealthy people had private security guards. That was forever. That's been a pattern. Rome did not have any police force. There was no police force in Rome. All social order of a coercive sort was the result of private security guards under the employ of ruling class patricians. You know, it's not that the plebs, well, maybe the plebs also had their own private security guards, I don't know. But so police get introduced. It's a deliberate policy. There's the city government realizes that the problems of social order are increasing, that at a minimum these are disruptive. They cause problems, and the solution to the problem is to have a non-corrupt, municipally paid police force. Now, that doesn't mean that the idea was, aha, if we don't do this, capitalism is going to be overthrown. The idea of social reproduction should not be thought of as always implying the counterfactual of the whole system collapsing. It's rather that there's a problem that's disrupting the functioning of these relations, and it requires an active intervention in order to solve this problem. Now, in the case of the early introduction of police, I suspect that it was probably more the problem of social order per se. It was more chaos that was at issue rather than transformation. That is, the problem of disorder was not primarily collective action threats to established power relations, but the more anarchic, individual, chaotic disorder from crime that was the issue for municipal police. But very quickly, police began to be used for purposes of reinforcing property rights and stabilizing social relations. So police were commonly used in around strikes, around protecting capitalist relations. The deployment of police in cities to protect the wealthier areas and abandon the poorer areas, that was a common practice, you know, right from the start of policing.
Do you know when that was, by the way, roughly?
I think the Metropolitan Police in Britain were 1830s.
I was going to say the first police force was in Glasgow in 1819,
so. Okay. So, and I think it became a kind of general thing in Britain in the 20s and 30s.
Yeah, they got a police bill for this at some point, I think.
Yeah.
Post-Napoleonic.
Yeah.
They did have like some kind of mechanism for like collecting taxes, though.
Oh, sure.
Way back when, that was kind of what we would think of as a police system today. Like, I mean, if you didn't pay your taxes, they would come get you and put you in.
Right. So I'm talking. I'm referring to the police as, the foot soldiers of social order for crime prevention, not just for. There were agents of the state that would be involved in issuing warrants. People were arrested before 1820, but there wasn't a police force. You know, you didn't have police offices, police stations in different parts of the town. You didn't have any of that apparatus. There was a coercive arm of the state. It just wasn't in the form of what we think of as police. Yeah.
Concerning the ideology problem, like there are some sort of ideology that help during the transformation process. So how does this like for example the Christian ideology, the like everyone's born equal and equality, freedom, free of thought. So how does this kind of ideology from the what you say is help to the capitalism that like have some negative effects or help to destroy it?
Well, remember, this is only the first of four components of the theory of transformation. We're beginning with the theory of reproduction, and the claim here is that ideology is one of the mechanisms of reproduction. Right? So ideology is one of the tools, just like coercion is one of the tools that the existing structure has available to build up specialized apparatuses of coercion in order to contribute to the social reproduction of the society and its class relations and other forms of oppression. That's the theory of reproduction. Now, the second part of the theory is the gaps and contradictions of reproduction. Right? So that show the second part of the second element of a theory of transformation is about a series of processes that make it possible, in spite of reproduction, for alternatives to be posed and organized. And one of the one of the elements of the gaps and contradictions of reproduction is precisely the contradictions within ideology that allow for alternative ideologies to emerge, which contradict rather than reinforce the dominant social relations. You have ideologies of resistance, not just ideologies of integration. And that's where the gaps and contradictions of reproduction, that's made possible by the gaps and contradictions of reproduction. All of these elements, coercion, institutional rules, ideology, and interest, can all act subversively. After all, when you have a strike, what strikers are doing is mobilizing coercion, both against non-striking workers. So one of the key problems in a strike is how the collective organization of workers are able to impose sanctions on non-participants to prevent strike breakers from breaking the strike, to apply coercion to scabs. So strikes, the organization of resistance of workers mobilize coercion. They certainly mobilize ideology. They have their own institutional rules inside of the class organizations, which attempt to create solidarities of resistance rather than solidarities of subordination. And of course, the interests of workers are absolutely fundamental to the success of strikes, being able to get workers to see that they are capable of acting on their interests against capital, not just subordinating their interests to the interests of capital. So all of these mechanisms of social reproduction can also be deployed to counteract social reproduction. But that's only possible because there are gaps and contradictions. If the system of social reproduction was as perfectly fine-tuned and totalizing, as some theories suggest, there'd be no space for an agency of alternative to emerge. Yeah?
I guess I just want to bring up a point. If it's desirable, you know, are coercion and ideology, are these not mechanisms that are kind of, we'll call it like capitalist mechanisms of control and maintaining a certain sort of society? That is it desirable for a union to coerce their members?
Sure.
Into, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
kind of like, are they not just using the same tools that the capitalist oppressors use? You know what I mean?
No, I think coercion and ideology are universal features of social relations and play a role in both reproducing and transforming relations. Now, the kind of coercion that's used, the way it's applied, the content of the ideologies, how they are formed, this varies a lot. When we discuss both the theory of the state and the theory of ideology, we will be exploring, you know, precisely these kinds of issues. It's impossible to be free of ideology, because I don't think ideology should be seen as a set of false beliefs instilled in people's heads through manipulative forms. Ideologies are simply the systematic character of the beliefs we hold. The content of those ideologies can either reinforce our subordination to existing power relations or can reinforce our solidarities of resistance. Those are both ideologies. That is, they're structures of belief that we've incorporated as social subjects. But they can lead us and underwrite different forms of action and resistance. Yeah?
I guess my concern would be even ideologies of resistance. I mean, if you're talking about active reproduction, there are mechanisms that when one embraces an ideology of resistance, these mechanisms continue to perpetuate the inequalities that exist already. I'm reminded of Paul Willis. He wrote Learning to Labor, how working class kids get working class jobs, and his main point was that there is the countercultural tendency in working class children in this particular community, this ethnography on it, and it was an ideology of resistance in many ways to what they saw as something that didn't necessarily wasn't to their benefit, a class ideology that was different. You know, theirs was not the privileged one, and this resistance continued, it marginalized them in the school, and it continued to perpetuate them to live a working class life instead of aspiring to be in a different class. So.
Right. So Paul Willis's views about resistance are similar to Herbert Marcuse's view about resistance more generally. Marcuse, in One Dimensional Man, introduces this notion of repressive tolerance, which basically every act of resistance to capitalism becomes an affirmation of capitalism. Why? Because it shows that capitalism can tolerate dissent. And so the act of dissent reinforces the view that the system is capable of pluralistically incorporating everything. Now, that is a completely demobilizing view. You know, if every act of dissent strengthens capitalism, and every act of non-dissent strengthens capitalism because it's an affirmation that nobody dissents from it, you know, then you're really just in a prison. That's an example of a view of reproduction as totalizing, where the mechanisms of social reproduction have so penetrated all aspects of life in a totalitarian way, I mean, even though it's done through liberal mechanisms, that there's no possibility of resistance. Paul Willis's argument has some features of that character. Every act of resistance of these lads has the character of just reinforcing their subordination to the system. Now, an alternative way of putting it is that those particular forms of resistance are actually forms of passive reproduction. They're not actually forms of resistance. It's just an illusion that they are. They're psychologically forms of resistance, but they're not sociologically forms of resistance. That for that, there would have to be collective action. There'd have to be collective action among the lads connected to the labor movement, to political parties that were challenging the structure of subordination that made their opportunity so limited, or something like that. And that it's the failure of collective action that's ruled out by active reproduction that makes that hard for people to solve. That makes all this individual kind of resistance actually both ineffectual with respect to the system and even functional for the system. I think, given that we are running out of time, I should just briefly touch on the remaining elements of this analysis. All of this is reproduction. Now, the second element is as important, if often neglected, which is to study this structure of social relations with an eye to identifying where the gaps and contradictions of reproduction lie. And to do so precisely because that's what shows where the opportunities and possibilities are. Remember, the whole purpose of a theory of transformation is to inform practices of struggle for transformation. Philosophers have only interpreted the world, the point is to change it. The point is to change it means we have to see where reproduction fails, where it's not totalizing, where it creates opportunities. And those are the sites where agency of a transformative sort can get some leverage. And the question then is, where do the gaps and contradictions come from? And I've identified four aspects of the way systems function which makes it extremely implausible that totalizing reproduction ever happens. And that when it seems to happen, it's probably because of an incorrect analysis of the way the system is functioning. You know, it's an illusion that the system is as totalizing as it might seem. And I've indicated four sources of contradictions. These are stated in very general ways, not dependent upon the substantive details of a Marxist account. So for each of these ways, there are specific Marxian versions, and we'll be discussing. So the first one is complexity and inconsistent requirements for social reproduction. Right? So that's the first way in which contradictions occur. Complexity and inconsistent requirements. The idea there is that a social system is a very complicated phenomenon in which it doesn't have a simple, if you do X, the system will stay in place. It's not like, it doesn't have a thermostat on the wall like a heating system for a room, where there's a single thing which triggers the furnace to go on to restore the equilibrium of the comfortable temperature, right? That's a very simple feedback system. Well, social systems have many requirements. As we'll see when we discuss the state, one of the arguments about the contradictory character of the state is that the state has to do many different things, and it can't do them all. You know, it needs to do A, B, and C in order to reproduce stably capitalist relations, but if it does A and B, C becomes harder. If it does B and C, A becomes harder. If it does A and C, B becomes impossible. It just can't solve all the problems. And so, inevitably, there's going to be disjunctures, gaps, failures, state errors. Not just as an accident, but inherent because of the complexity of functional requirements. That's one of the themes we'll discuss around the theory of the state. Strategic intentionality and its ramifications. This is basically the fact that institutions aren't created by omnipotent social engineers unaffected by the grubby struggles and personalities of the practical world. No, the institutions we've got are the result of very messy processes of struggle and contestation in which there are winners and losers, and the winners win by designing the institutions in particular ways which make life harder for others. But the designs that occur always occur under conditions of limited knowledge and compromise between contending factors, often dominated by idiots. So, it's if you want another little slogan, never overestimate the intelligence of the ruling class. You know, the present era being a prime example, where dominant class forces are supporting really stupid positions from the point of view of the stable reproduction of capitalism. I don't mean stupid positions from the point of view of human emancipation and flourishing of children. I mean stupid positions with respect to what over the next 30 years will make for a stable and vibrant capitalist economy. They're adopting and pushing stupid positions. That's because they are operating under very bad theories. I don't think it's because they have a bad understanding of their interests, it's that they have a bad set of beliefs about what institutions would serve their interests. Right? Now that makes it, that's a normal feature of capitalism. Fortunately for ruling classes in capitalism, capitalism is not such a fragile system that needs super fine tuning with optimal institutions in order for it to muddle through. It's a loosely coupled system where, in the absence of any challenging alternative, can muddle through well, even if badly. That's the kind of saving grace for the capitalist class in the world we live in, that they can do a hatchet job and botch it and still do okay, because the system isn't like an organism. You know, it's not like a person, which if you really mistreat the body, you die. That's not true about capitalism. You can deeply mistreat its conditions of existence and it can still muddle through. But that's another reason why there's contradictions, because the designers, when they win, botch it. They don't do it well. Institutional rigidities and path dependency, that's the kind of common argument which I think has tremendous explanatory value and is a super interesting site of lots of research, that once institutions created, then you've got a double problem of social reproduction going on. And this is a really interesting part of the complexity of social problems. You have mechanisms that reproduce those institutions. So you have a, you create an institution, the state, a particular kind of bureaucracy. You create it to solve a problem in the economy, so it helps to reproduce the economy. But you also stabilize that institution by creating career paths, by creating institutional rules for how it works that help to reproduce that institution itself. Now the thing is, that makes the institutions rigid. It makes them harder to change. But that's what you wanted. You wanted to create a stable institution. But what happens if the conditions in the economy change? And you need different kinds of interventions, but you've created a rigid set of machinery that's incapable of responding flexibly. The problem is, if it was able to respond flexibly, it might have responded flexibly in other interests. So there's a contradiction that's generated by the task of building stable institutions and the task of having flexible institutions. That's this rigidity and path dependency. And then finally, there's simply contingencies and unpredictability, just things that were not expected and in which the existing structures are incapable of responding to precisely because they weren't designed to do so. All of those create gaps and contradictions of reproduction. And we are out of time. We will be talking about the trajectory of unintended social change. That is the main object of the next couple of weeks, the theory of history. And I think the strategies of transformation component is something which we will especially return to at the end of the semester. And on Wednesday, we will begin our adventure with G.A. Cohen's Karl Marx's Theory of History of Defense.